Doctor, we'll get you right off to a good hot question here. The press reports that you used your influence to obtain a preferment for a bank charter with the Federal Home Loan Bank. Will you please explain fully your intercession and why?
I did make a telephone call to Mr. McMurray, the head of the Home Loan Bank Board, some months ago. On behalf of the Franklin Savings and Loan Association of Miami, Florida, a group came to me from this association expressing their interest in getting the charter, stating that there was no fiscal institution in the Negro community of Miami, and stating that the board was interracial. After I talked with them, I felt that this was a worthwhile venture. I felt that there was a real need for a fiscal institution in that community, something that I have stressed over and over again, that we must develop thrift, we must save and lift ourselves by our own economic bootstraps at points. So that because of my interest in seeing this, and because of the fact that I do not know of any strong interracial savings and loan association in the South, I felt that it was something worthwhile. I simply called Mr. McMurray to make a character recommendation, since I knew some of the men on the board and knew that they were men of great and genuine integrity. I also felt that this would be a new level in race relations with an interracial group in the South forming a savings and loan association. At that time, I did not know that another group was seeking a charter. It was only a month later, when I was in Miami addressing the AFL-CIO convention, that I discovered that another group was competing or seeking a charter. So when I made the call to Mr. McMurray, I had no knowledge of another group.
We have a question here about your speech to the AFL convention, Doctor. Would you care to tell us whether the report is true that your friend, Attorney Stanley Levison, wrote the speech you made before the AFL convention?
No, my friend Stanley Levison did not write the speech that I made before the AFL-CIO convention. I don't have the good fortune of having speech writers, so that I write all of the speeches I make, including the one that I made at the AFL-CIO convention.
Has the federal government been giving the Albany movement sufficient help? If not, what suggestions do you have?
Certainly the federal government has been concerned. The Justice Department has been in Albany. The FBI, I think, is on the job in Albany right now. I do think that is more that can be done, because I think basic constitutional rights are being denied. The persons who are protesting in Albany, Georgia, are merely seeking to exercise constitutional rights through peaceful protest, nonviolent protest, and I think that the people in Albany are being denied their rights on the basis of the First Amendment of the Constitution. And I think it would be a very good thing for the federal government to take a definite stand on this issue, even if it means joining with Negro attorneys who are working now in the situation, and not only Negro attorneys, but many attorneys who are working in the situation, making it clear that these constitutional rights are being denied.
Would you comment on the recent Supreme Court decision on prayers in the public school system?
I know that this decision has received a great deal of criticism. I would say simply that this decision was a sound and a good decision, reaffirming something that is basic in our Constitution, namely separation of church and state. It was a reaffirmation of a basic constitutional principle. And I think the criticisms have been centered on issues that were nowhere in the decision. For those who believe in God, he is still on his throne, and the Supreme Court decision did nothing to dethrone God, and it did nothing to say that prayer is wrong. It simply reaffirmed this great principle of the separation of church and state.
Since the Department of Justice and the courts are pressing for the enforcement of Negro rights, why do you condone extra legal activities such as sit-ins and demonstrations?
This question will take a little longer than others because it goes into the whole matter of civil disobedience. And it is true at points that in the sit-ins and some of our other developments in the South, we have broken laws. And this is a very difficult thing to understand when on the one hand we say obey the law when it deals with the 1954 decision of the Supreme Court, and on the other hand we say break laws. First, I would like to say that while we are practicing civil disobedience in the South, we are practicing civil obedience to the Constitution and the federal government. The other thing is that I believe firmly that we must obey laws, we must respect law. I believe this firmly. But there are two types of laws. There are just and unjust laws. And I don't think any moral person can adjust to and patiently respect and follow unjust laws. Now the question comes, what is an unjust law and what is a just law, and who determines this? First, I would say that an unjust law is a law that is out of harmony with the moral laws of the universe. Any law that degrades human personality is out of harmony with the moral laws of the universe, and therefore it is an unjust law. By the same token, a just law is a law that is in line with the moral principles of the universe. Well, somebody would say that's a little too abstract. I don't believe in those abstract things called moral laws, so make it a little more concrete. I would say that an unjust law is a code which a majority inflicts on the minority, which is not binding on itself. This is difference made legal, wherein a just law is a code that a majority compels a minority to follow, which it is willing to follow itself. This is sameness made legal. I would also say that an unjust law is a code which a majority inflicts on a minority, which that minority had no part in enacting or creating because it was denied the right to vote. Who can say that the legislative bodies of the South that brought in all of these segregation laws were democratically elected, these persons who formed the legislative bodies. Now, in order to protect ourselves from anarchy, we do not say defy the law, we do not say evade the law. We say that these laws are to be disagreed with or even broken openly, and they are to be done publicly. They are to be done, they are to be broken non-violently. And I submit that any individual who comes to the point that he has to break a law that conscience tells him is unjust and willingly accepts the penalty for it is at that moment expressing the very highest respect for law. And we are not practicing anarchy. We are merely saying that there are some laws unjust, and the only way to call this to the attention of the community is to break them and suffer the penalty by staying in jail if necessary. Now, of course, this is nothing new. It goes back into history for many years. In the Old Testament, the three Hebrew boys in the fiery furnace, so to speak, and the early Christians practiced civil disobedience superbly to the point that they were thrown to the lions. Socrates, to an extent, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience. We must never forget that everything that Hitler did in Germany was legal, in quotes. It was illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. And I believe firmly if I had lived there with my present attitude, I would have broken that law. Everything that Chief Luthuli is doing in South Africa is against the law. And certainly what is more in line with civil disobedience and the Boston Tea Party, so that even this nation came into being to an extent through civil disobedience.
What is your frank appraisal of President Kennedy's civil rights efforts? Specifically, is he moving ahead fast enough?
It's very difficult to give a yes or no answer to this question. I would say first that President Kennedy is friendly to civil rights. The new administration, I feel, has done much more than the predecessor administration in civil rights. I would say that the new administration has created a climate of concern for civil rights. And as I said in my talk, I think the Justice Department has moved in a very forthright manner in the sensitive area of voter registration. On the other hand, there are some things to be desired. The fact that the President has not signed an executive order eliminating discrimination in federally assisted housing, the fact that the President has not taken a vigorous stand for civil rights legislation means that there is still a great deal to be done, and I must honestly say that I do not think the President has yet given the kind of leadership in this area that the enormity of the problem demands.
Do you feel that the news media have generally been fair in their treatment of your activities?
Yes, I do. I think generally the press has been very fair. Now, this would not apply to the press all of the press, because we have the Southern press, and some of the Southern papers are fair and objective in their reporting and in their editorials. On the other hand, we know that some are very unfair, and some stand in the way of progress. But when we look at the picture as a whole, I would say that the press has done a good job in objective, clear, meaningful reporting.
How do you explain the growing competition between race relations organizations? Is it because many groups want to take credit for imminent victories, or does it represent a philosophical split that will retard progress?
I do not think we have a great deal of competition and disunity as we often feel, as is said so often. I think we do have many approaches coming into being, some new and I feel creative approaches. There is no one lane road that leads to the city of freedom. I think there are several avenues, but they are all moving the same way. Some may move down the lane of litigation and stressing legislation. Some may move down the lane of nonviolent direct action. Some may move down the lane of emphasizing education and research and preparing the Negro to face the challenges of a highly urbanized society. But it is all moving. They are all moving in the same direction, all toward this city, so to speak, of integration and first-class citizenship. I think what we have at this point is the fact that these new methods are coming into being, and we are at the point where we are trying to bring them together as supplements rather than substituting for something else. And the differences are minor, I feel. They are human differences, but there is no basic disunity in the Negro struggle and in the organizations guiding and leading this struggle. I think at bottom we are all moving the same way, and we are all moving toward the same goal.
How much do you owe to Mr. Gandhi in your philosophy and technique? How well does nonviolence work here? I might say that's an Indian correspondent asked that question.
Well, I would say I owe a great deal to Mahatma Gandhi for my own commitment to nonviolence. I would say that we gained the operational technique for this movement from the great movement that took place in India. Now, of course, there are differences, and we recognize these differences. We are in a different cultural situation. The Indian people constituted a numerical majority seeking to gain freedom in a situation where a numerical minority ruled. wherein in the United States we are a numerical minority. Also, there's a distinction between integration and independence. On the one hand, a foreign invader is being driven out. In America, we are seeking to gain freedom within a situation where we will have to live with the same people the minute we get that freedom. And so there are differences. But I think the basic philosophy itself, the basic method is the same, and that is that it is possible to stand up against an unjust system, resist it with determination, and yet not stoop to violence and hatred in the process.
Do you feel that passive resistance could be effective against a communist state, or is it only possible against nations such as the U.S. and Britain?
There can be no gainsaying of the fact that passive resistance works better in a situation where you have a potential ally in the conscience of your opponent. It works better in a democratic situation where you have the freedom of the press and freedom of speech and assembly, or it's much more difficult to organize a passive resistance movement in a totalitarian situation. On the other hand, we have no empirical evidence that this method cannot work in a situation where you have a totalitarian regime reigning. It has not been tried on a massive scale in situations like that. And I still feel that it is a possibility, even though it is more difficult. Certainly, it is more difficult to have a passive resistance movement in South Africa than it is in the United States. But one of the only successful movements in South Africa on the part of the Africans was a passive resistance movement when they had the bus boycott back in 1956 or 7, and it actually brought the government to its knees. So that even in a situation as difficult as South Africa, passive resistance has worked. And I believe that although it is more difficult, it may work in a situation where you have a totalitarian regime.
To what extent have you been helped by progress in Africa?
I think we've been helped a great deal by the progress in Africa. Certainly, no one can ignore what is taking place in Africa. And we are sensitive, not only, when I say we, I mean we as a nation, are sensitive to world opinion. We are concerned about this. And the rolling tide of world opinion has helped, I believe, in our struggle. And I think the new determination of the African people, the new sense of dignity, in a real sense, has given to the Negro a new sense of dignity and a new sense of a new determination. So in short, I think we have been helped a great deal by what is taking place in Africa today.
Well, along that line, Doctor, how do you feel about the totalitarian regimes in Ghana and Guinea?
I think it is all too easy to oversimplify at this point, oversimplify the problem, and to make certain accusations that may not be valid if one takes a look at the whole situation. I would take Ghana first. I'm sure President Nkrumah has made some mistakes. On the other hand, I think we will have to see the problems that he has confronted. It is not an easy thing to lift a nation from a tribal tradition into a democratic thrust without having problems. And it may well be that if there had not been a strong leader in Ghana like Mr. Nkrumah, we would have many of the same problems there that we had in the Congo. For he confronted something of the same problem where you had Katanga province in the Congo, you had the Ashanti tribe in Ghana, and the same problem could have developed if there had not been strong leadership. I'm not justifying any mistakes that have been made. I'm simply saying that there are two sides, and I think we have to see the problems that these men confront as they attempt to lead their nations on in the modern world.
What do you think of the black Muslim movement?
Well, it's only natural that I would disagree with the basic philosophy of this movement. I have said on many occasions that I firmly believe that black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. I also feel that there are certain points in the movement that are unrealistic, such as the attempt to separate rather than integrate. And the whole talk about moving out to certain new areas and getting a certain area set aside for the Negro to live in separation. This I would disagree with because I believe in integration. On the other hand, I must affirm that this movement did not come into being out of thin air. It is symptomatic of the deeper unrest, the frustrations, and the discontent of Negro people. In other words, some conditions brought the movement here. And while on the one hand it is necessary to condemn the philosophy and disagree with it, I think it is just as important for people of goodwill to work to remove the conditions that brought this movement into being. And so I am not as worried about the Muslim movement as I am about these conditions that brought it here. For as long as we have the conditions of social isolation and economic deprivation, discrimination in so many areas, movements like this will spring up. So it is at once a challenge to all people of goodwill to seek to remove the conditions that brought it into being.
Before I ask the final question, Doctor, I'd like you to present you with our certificate of appreciation and a copy of Sherrod Lew, 50 Years History of the Press Club. Now for the final question. Your all-Benny, Georgia, appearance on TV was very exuberant and your audience rose to great excitement. Today, your appearance is subdued and restrained. Do you have a split personality?
Well, I guess I'm trying to be a strong man. One great French philosopher said, no man can be strong unless he combines in his character antitheses strongly marked. I guess the strong man must be militant and moderate. But in all seriousness, I don't think I have a split personality. In Albany, Georgia, I am in a different situation. We are in the midst of a great struggle and a great movement there, and the conditions are altogether different. Here, I am in the National Press Club in the capital of the nation, and I'm sure that my analysis of the problem and my attempt to get over certain ideas would be totally different from Albany. For in Albany, I'm seeking to develop certain decisions. And I think there is a difference here between getting a lecture over and getting something else over. The dominant point in a lecture is the subject to be explained, but the dominant point in a speech in a civil rights movement where you're trying to arouse people is the object to be attained, and pleading with people to make a decision for a great cause and a great movement. But basically, my approach is always the same in philosophy, and that is that we must adhere to nonviolence to the core. And I believe that through this approach, we will be able to transform not only Albany, Georgia, but the whole of our nation and move on toward that great goal of brotherhood under the fatherhood of God.
Thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned.